1 Samuel chapter 20. The beauty of this chapter is this is the core of the David-Jonathan relationship, friendship. So just keep that in mind as we go through this. Verses 1 through 23, the first portion of this chapter deal with David and Jonathan. They were best of friends. They were also, in addition to being best friends, brothers-in-law. Remember, David married Michal, Saul's daughter, Jonathan's sister. So they were, in addition to being best friends, they were also brothers-in-law. Jonathan, now back in chapter 19, you may recall that Jonathan had effected a reconciliation of sorts between his father Saul and David. When Saul had told his soldiers and Jonathan, anybody, any one of you see David, kill him. And any one of them could have stabbed David in the back. David's life was in a precarious position. And Jonathan went to his father Saul and pleaded on David's behalf. And Saul relented and basically recanted what he had said there and what he said. So Jonathan was still under the impression that Saul was not at odds with David, not out for his life. But it was not so. Saul had changed his mind again. And we read at the beginning of chapter 20, so surprising that David was expected, along with many other soldiers and others in Saul's court, to be present at Saul's table. David was expected to resume sitting at the royal table. So one thought could be that maybe, remember, this is not the author of the book, it's the compiler of the book, and he took his material from different source documents. So maybe this took place at an earlier time, but this is the way they are set out, and we are now at chapter 20, the way the compiler has laid them. That's one thought. But on the other hand, it's not surprising if this was in chronological order, because the vacillations in Saul up and down, he received David, he hated David, he accepted him, he wanted to slay him. And so that's not surprising when you see the mental deterioration or the personality deterioration in Saul as the Spirit of the Lord had left him and he was left to his own ends. Here, this is surprising when we think of David and Jonathan's friendship. It's surprising that both these men, for different reasons, expected to be king someday. David, because of the secret anointing by Samuel. Jonathan, because he was the crown prince and heir apparent, the son of Saul. Both these men, for different reasons, expected to be kings someday, and they were not deadly enemies. Also, at this point in time, Jonathan could have let David down, but we know that God would have protected David anyway, and as history records, David then could have completely finished off every living remaining person of Saul's family. But we find in the record later on, years later, when David becomes king, David spares the one living remnant of Saul's household, a lame man named Mephibosheth. Both these men kept their word to one another. They placed their friendship above the aspirations or the hopes of one day becoming king. And as I mentioned, the whole theme of chapter 20 is friendship. Friendships, I have this in your sheets, I believe, are not cemented in a solicitor's office. True friendship envisages loyalty, faithfulness, commitment, dedication, and self-sacrifice. A friendship that is broken as soon as difficulties arise is not worth the name. Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loveth at all times. A friend loveth at all times. We also read Proverbs 18:24b, the second half says, there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. We have the old adage that we know a friend in need is a friend indeed. Jonathan proved that he was just such a friend. One scholar has put, friendship is one of life's most enriching experiences. Friendship is one of life's most enriching experiences. Now get this thought. You and I cannot take our money, our houses, our cars, our planes to heaven. But I looked at Dave. He's got a little plane. It's really neat. I saw that. Single engine plane. But it's for him. I'll stay with the jumbos, okay? I feel safer in them. Big, four, huge, massive engines. But you and I cannot take these things to heaven. The only thing that we can take to heaven is our relationships. And the people we led to Christ is the only thing you and I can take to heaven. Friendship enrich life. Friendship is one of life's most enriching experiences. They're the only thing we can take from earth to heaven. How poor is the person who is friendless? Friends enrich life because they give without counting the cost. Friends enrich life because they give without counting the cost. Jonathan gave David. There is no question. Jonathan, being the son of Saul, was in the position to give David protection, to give him tips, to give him help, to give him hints, to warn him. Jonathan gave David far more than he ever received from David, and he couldn't because he was killed in battle a short while later. Even if David wanted to repay when he became king, he couldn't. But that's part of what being a friend is about. A friend gives. Jonathan gave David more than he received, and this was so different from the typical king. Remember, Samuel outlined, if you want a king is going to rule and to take, whereas the prophet and the priest was to serve and to give. But Jonathan, the crown prince, the heir apparent, he was a giver, though he was the crown prince. Jonathan gave David more than he received. He was different from the typical king or prince who would take. And to close this thought on friendship and Jonathan, life has its givers and takers, but Jonathan was supremely a giver. That so refreshed me. Life has its givers and takers, but Jonathan was supremely a giver. Verse 15 of chapter 20, we read that Jonathan, in this conversation with David, he's far-sighted. Even though in the natural order of things he should have become the next king, he senses David's going to become the king, and he is pleading to David now, when David's still in danger of his life, for mercy for his, Jonathan's family and his people, when David becomes king. Foresighted, far-sighted. And Jonathan asks for mercy when David becomes king for his family. And that is fulfilled, I mentioned earlier, in 2 Samuel chapter 9 with Mephibosheth. Verses 24 through 42, the second half of this chapter, we have the test of friendship. And here you find that there's the Israeli court etiquette where on special occasions, in this case the occasion was that of the new moon, the courtiers were... It was necessary, they had to dine with the king on these special occasions and festivals. And if you were a courtier or a nobleman or a soldier of repute and you wanted to stay away, you had to get special permission to be away, either from Saul the king or perhaps from Jonathan the crown prince. And of course, David doesn't show up for the feast because he knows Saul is out to get him. Imagine the dynamics of the situation. Saul wants to slay David, and David's technically supposed to be there at the table. And so David stays away. He talks with Jonathan early, ahead of time. They've got a deal made, and they have a certain way that Jonathan's going to communicate with him. And after the first day, of course, Saul is looking, scouring this table over. Where's David? David's not there. He doesn't say a thing. And the scripture indicates that Saul thought maybe he is unclean, ceremonially unclean, and that maybe he touched a dead body. You know, you slew a Philistine, so you touch his dead body. So for a couple of days, you're unclean. So maybe that's why he's not here. Second day goes. Third day, Saul can't bear it any longer because the last day of the feast. And he asks around. He directly asks Jonathan, where's David? And they had planned a bluff, where David is going to tell Saul if Saul asked about, Jonathan was going to tell Saul if Saul asked about David. Well, his father in his hometown of Bethlehem had a feast, so David's gone up to celebrate. Saul calls that bluff. He doesn't believe it at all. He gets so angry with Jonathan, he uses a very coarse, base, vulgar expletive. He says, thou son of that rebellious woman, whoever Jonathan's mother was is not the point. But he's using a very vulgar expletive, abusing Jonathan's mother and Jonathan in the process in his fit of rage. And Saul goes on to say, even though he's very angry, he speaks the truth. He says, don't you realize, you rebel, Jonathan, you son of mine, that as long as the son of Jesse is alive, you will never be established upon the throne of Israel. And Jonathan responds by saying, but what has he done to you? And Saul, remember this, even before, he had the spear or the javelin constantly beside him, picks that up and now throws the spear at his own son, Jonathan, who, it doesn't say, but it's understood, evades and avoids the spear just like David did. Now, this is so ironic. On the one breath, Saul is telling his own son, using expletives to describe him, that he will never be established as king as long as David, the son of Jesse, is alive. And the next breath, he's trying to kill the same son whose kingdom he's trying to establish just before this with what he said. You see the deterioration of King Saul's personality. What's happening? His whole mind is crumbling. His anger and rage is taking control here. And you know, Jonathan then said, what did he do after he evades the javelin? Jonathan gets up and stalks out of that place in front of the other courtiers. It must have been quite a dramatic scene, folks. He is very angry, but you still see the character of Jonathan coming forth in a way he does not lip his father, evades that javelin, walks out, stalks out of that place, and goes for a walk to cool off. Of course, now he's got to fulfill his bargain with David as to communicate with David. It's not a good time for you to come. I think you better start permanently going on the run. Permanently. And really, it's a result of this that David finally goes into complete exile. We find the truth that Saul spoke was in verse 31a, where he said, as long as the son of Jesse is on the throne, you will never be established as king. Don't you realize that? And that was true, but in his heart and mind, David was never seditious. He never planned, plotted, or schemed to take the throne from Saul. And here we have Jonathan's final sign as he leaves that dining hall, or banquet hall. Final sign of loyal friendship. It was to warn David. They had earlier made this deal where Jonathan said, if my father is not angry at you, I will come out and shoot 3 arrows, and I'll send a boy out to collect the arrows. And if I tell him they're on this side, then it's safe. You hear what I'm telling, shouting out at the boy, you can come. But if I shoot them and tell the boy the arrows are beyond you, that means don't come, don't show your face, go away. And again, Jonathan's friendship is standing out. He goes out to the field, takes the boy with him, shoots the 3 arrows, and then he yells out beyond the boy, the arrows are beyond thee. And when the boy collects them, Jonathan changes plans. He knows that David's going to go away when he hears that. But they are such dear friends, he wants to say goodbye to his friend David. So he shouts to the boy, the arrows are beyond thee. The boy collects the arrows, comes back. Jonathan changes plans. He does 3 things. One, he sends the boy away. Secondly, he meets with David. He has a meeting with David before David can leave. And thirdly, it says, when they met, Jonathan wept. David and Jonathan wept on each other. Embrace each other, kiss each other, say farewell to one another. And Jonathan realizes that no more will I be able to meet with you, my friend David, freely in the king's court. You're going to be in exile. And there's nothing more Jonathan can do. He has saved David's life. They part ways, David to the wilderness, Jonathan back to the king's palace, to the court. Before they leave, Jonathan confirms the oath between their two families. In verse 42, you read that. And here's a thought, just to note as we end this chapter. Nobody, not even the crown prince Jonathan, tried to obstruct David's rise to the position of king, except Saul, who was of disturbed mind, fighting in vain against God's will. Let's turn over now to chapter 21. Chapter 21 of 1 Samuel, verses 1 through 10. We have David, he is now in exile, it's established, there's no way he's going to come back to the court, and he runs now or flees to the town or the city of Nob. David was now a fugitive, he was an outlaw. We also pick up that now the tabernacle of God, the Israelite tabernacle, is in the city of Nob. All the priests are there, most of them. But even the sanctuary provided no asylum for David. David could not even find asylum or protection in the sanctuary. When David went to the city of Nob, he went to where the tabernacle was kept, and the priest's name was Ahimelech. The word records that Ahimelech came out trembling trembling to meet David. In other words, why have you come here? Your very presence here, you're an outlaw, you're a fugitive. If you sin with me, Saul could kill me in a fit of rage because I harbored you in this temple. Even the tabernacle did not provide David with any asylum. Ahimelech came trembling, we read in verse 1. But David was no rebel. He instigated no uprising, but yet he had to be on the run. But we find that time and again, constantly, God protected him because, and here's a word of encouragement for us this morning, because nothing can thwart God's plans. Nothing could thwart God's plans for David to become king of Israel. And God has a special, unique plan for every one of us here. And this was the word the Lord gave me this last night. Nothing, tell them, Andrew, nothing can thwart God's plans for your life. And he gave me a scripture to go with that, Jeremiah 29:11, where the Lord says, "For I know the plans that I have for you, plans for evil and not, plans for good and not for evil, to give you an established end." In other words, nothing, my child, will thwart the plans that I have for you. Nothing could prevent David from coming ultimately to the throne, and nothing and nobody can stand in your way when God has a particular end in sight for you. So be encouraged. However, we see a few faults of David here when he came to Nob, and in all fairness, we need to not highlight them, but study them. Before that, a thought. Why did David behave in this way when we come to these faults that we're going to discuss? His faults stemmed from one characteristic, fear. If you're in first service, Pastor Sam touched on it, and if you're going for second, you'll hear it again. Same thought now. The faults of David stem from fear. Some people, regarding fear now, I'm talking about us. Some people show it, others conceal it, but all know it. I don't care how macho the men may think we are, but everybody knows the experience of fear. Especially when you're in a big plane and you hit an air pocket and your stomach is in your mouth. It doesn't matter how versatile a traveler you may be, some people show it, others conceal it, but all know it. Now listen to this thought about fear. Heroes and cowards are both afraid. The difference is they run in opposite directions. One runs home, the other runs towards the enemy. Heroes and cowards are both afraid. They just run in opposite directions. Here are some of David's faults. Number one, deceit. When he came to Ahimelech and Ahimelech was trembling, David saw that. He didn't want to be chased out from there. He lied to Ahimelech, the priest, and said, "Saul sent me here on an errand." David lied. He used deceit, but we understand it came from his fear. So David, number one, he used deceit. He lied to Ahimelech. He said, "Saul sent me." Secondly, there was selfishness. Because why was the priest shaking with fear? He was quaking for his own life, that he would be associated with David. And so David was, there was selfishness where he put his own concern for his own safety above the safety of Ahimelech the high priest and all the other priests in Nob at the tabernacle. Here's a thought about that which we'll come to later. When David was talking to Ahimelech, there was a man there called Doeg, D-O-E-G, the Edomite. And he was a suspicious character who was one of Saul's henchmen. And David saw Doeg and knew that this was a dangerous situation. He should have told Ahimelech, "Can I talk to you one-on-one?" But he asked right there in the presence of Doeg, and Doeg was the cause of a tremendous disaster shortly after that, being an eyewitness and being able to hear what happened. So David put his own safety above the safety of the others. There was selfishness shown in that. And thirdly, David's attitude at Nob, his whole attitude, stands in stark contrast. The fear that seemed to motivate him to do these things for his own skin, his attitude at Nob stands in stark contrast to the serene faith he showed when confronting Goliath. What happened to that faith? Fear had replaced it now. Faith must be exercised on a daily basis. The same David who had tremendous mountain-moving faith to challenge Goliath, who ran up to Goliath to the battle point, now was being motivated by faith. That tells us something. Faith must be exercised on a daily basis. Yesterday's faith is no guarantee of today's trust and fidelity. And the Lord was giving me a little thought from that, especially for the men. You know, unless our case is different. Just because I said I love you to my wife before we got married and at the altar, it doesn't mean I don't need to say it every single day. Because it's much easier for her to tell me with my personality, honey, I love you. If it's the last thing and I'm dog tired, and then if I grunt, it's not enough. I need to say it. I love you too. Yesterday is faith. Yesterday is love. There's no guarantee of today's trust and fidelity. It needs to be renewed, reinforced, strengthened every day. And where was David at? He ran to meet Goliath, and here he was in fear, covering his own skin with selfishness and fear. And here is the brief incident itself. David's hungry, a few of his folk who are with him are hungry, and he asks for something to eat, and the priest says there is no coal, C-H-O-L, meaning common bread for anybody to eat. There's only the holy bread, which is the showbread on the table for the priest. And David said, give it to us anyway. He said, if your men haven't touched a woman for so many days, etc., if you're ceremonially clean and pure for the spirit of time, then you can have it. And so they ate it, and he also, Ahimelech the priest, gave David, guess what? Goliath's sword that David himself had taken, that was put in the tabernacle. Ahimelech the priest gives that to David. David said, I was in such a hurry, I didn't have a chance to get my sword. Do you have anything? Here, take Goliath's sword. So that was the actual incident that took place. And it's quite interesting, because when Jesus in the New Testament, I've shown you three of David's weaknesses, but when Jesus refers back to this incident, he doesn't pinpoint one of David's weaknesses. The Lord knew all of us are susceptible and subject to the pangs of fear at times, and that's what brought David to this point. But the only reason Jesus used this was to point out to those pharisaical, hypocritical priest class of his time, don't talk to me about ceremonial laws. Jesus was trying to say, what happened? How come when Jesus and the disciples plucking corn on the Sabbath day, what about David when he and his soldiers took the bread that's meant only for the priests? In other words, it's the spirit of the law and not the letter of the law. It's the letter that kills, the spirit gives life. And that's the only context in which Jesus reflected back to this one incident. And the thought, as far as the personal application from that, let us never judge a person, let us never judge a man without taking into account his circumstances. It is so easy for us to sit back and judge from the security of our armchair, sitting there in front of the TV, and we hear this about whoever, and it's so easy to make our comments and judge people from the security of our armchair. I heard this quip years ago. Before you accuse, criticize, and abuse, walk a mile in my shoes. Before you accuse, criticize, and abuse, walk a mile in my shoes. Verses 11 through 15 of chapter 21, we have David at Gath. You know, that name Gath should ring a bell. Goliath came from Gath. He was Goliath of Gath, the giant. And now David's going for refuge to Achish, the king of Gath. David now is afraid of the king of the same Philistine city whose giant champion he once slew. Why is he afraid when he goes on? Here's a thought straight from scripture. Verse 12a of chapter 21. We'll read there. This chapter 21. Okay. This is verse 10a. And David arose and fled that day, went to Achish. It's verse 12. And David laid these words in his heart and was sore afraid. David laid up these words in his heart. In verse 11, he hears what they were saying, but David paid attention to what the Philistines who lived in the city of Gath said. That caused him to be afraid. Who are we receiving our input from? The people of God or the people out in the world? David, listening to the input of the people of Gath, it says David became afraid. And now he was here in fear of the king of Gath, the king of the same Philistine city whose giant champion he once slew. And here was imminent danger to David, and again he resorts to, we may call it, deceit. He feigns, pretends madness. And one of the outward things was that he allowed his spittle to run down his beard. Evidently, he had a beard at this time. Makes sense. He was on the run. He wasn't at home with a razor at his beck and call. No, they didn't have razors. Whatever they had. But he feigns madness. And why madness? There are a couple of reasons. In the East, in those days, and perhaps to this day too, madmen or people who are insane were treated as taboo. Don't tease them. People will tell their kids, don't even tease those people. One, out of pity, sure. But the other, it was almost looked upon as an affliction of the gods. Small g, of course. And in some sense, that's true. Because the quote-unquote gods that they worship are demons. And it could be a result of demon possession. So in that sense, it is an affliction of their gods, which is demons. And so they were treated as taboo, if not to them, holy people. And here's a thought, that in those days, no man in his right mind would violate his beard. And David allowed his spittle to trickle down his beard. So that almost confirmed to them, yes, he must be mad or crazy. However, you can look at this from another perspective. We've said he resorted to deceit, but he also showed a leadership quality of being astute. Here he was with his back to the wall, chased by Saul, faced with King Achish of Gath, and he's rather astute, and you see Achish is somewhat gullible by believing that. But this incident is not a license to believers to resort to such things because David did it. We have the higher law of Christ, and we need to walk in integrity even if our lives are lives are at stake. Chapter 22, let's go to verses 1 through 10. Now David comes to the cave of Adullam, where quite an interesting incident takes place. It's in his native Judah, southern powerful tribe of Judah, the cave of Adullam. Actually, these caves were large caves, enough to house family, relatives, and even soldiers and other men. At this point in time, David had a gathering of about 400 men. Where did they come from? There's a lot of reason to believe that there would have been many discontented, disconcerted dissidents with Saul's maladministration at this time. Picture Saul. He has been vacillating from leading his army to victory against the Philistines to times when he wanted to spear his own son Jonathan, let alone David. And there would have been many discontents in his kingdom. And by this time, about 400 of them have gathered to David. We also read when he did come to his native tribe of Judah, many of his brothers, his family members, his parents came, and others who knew him from his hometown to rally around and support him. But there were 400 of them at this point. It would seem outwardly that it's like a military uprising, but it was not for an offensive against Saul. It was to defend himself against Saul, and others who were discontented came and joined him. There was no way David was going to lead a rebellion. But imagine what Saul is thinking. Now, news is getting to the king Saul that David is raising an army to attack you, and feelings of terrible insecurity begin to attack Saul in his mind. And that sets the stage for what's going to continue to happen here. Now, the thought about the word stronghold, these caves provided a beautiful setting, a beautiful hideaway place, and the Hebrew word is metsuda, which simply means stronghold. It appears in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 22. Now, it says here that David, you can imagine, his parents weren't very young at this time, and they couldn't rush and get up and move whenever they're being chased by, like the rest of the soldiers and David himself. And so he takes his parents and puts them in Moab, in a safe place. And this was interesting for one scholar to come up with this. David was the son of Jesse, who's the son of Obed, who's the son of Boaz and Ruth. The book of Ruth comes just before 1 Samuel. Ruth was his, what, great-grandmother, whatever, okay? So they would have had relatives in Moab. And David takes his dad and mom and takes them to Moab to be safe there. That was quite an interesting connection for me to make. Okay, so David puts his parents there so that he can now be ready to move at the drop of a hat for safety from Saul's seeking after his life. Verse 5, we have the mention of another seemingly unknown prophet, Gad. And Gad, David, what's the significance of this? David has a prophet with him. He is already, see, no lone individual had his personal prophet. But the king and the nation had the prophet. David, though he's in exile, he doesn't really have an army. He's got 400 men who are with him. He's starting to look more like a king, even though he's trying so hard not to. The prophet's in his camp is with him. So David's got the prophet, and Samuel has none. Saul's stalked away from him, remember? Chapter 15, where Samuel stalked away where Saul rent his garment. So we have, though in exile, David's beginning to look more and more like a king, and Saul had lost all his prophetic support. And in verses 6 through 10, we now see Saul gets paranoid. He cannot break through David's providential protection. Of course he will never find David. Because God, nothing can thwart the plans that God has for you and I, in this case for David. And Saul is frustrated. He is fear-filled. Men are beginning to gather around David, and he cannot find him. How hard he tries, he cannot break through David's providential, God-given protection. And it's a sorry picture when you start to think of Saul now. And he begins to become deeply suspicious of his own entire court. And he senses the kingdom is slipping away from him. He feels less and less like a king. He begins to feel isolated and all alone. A lonely, bitter, angry, suspicious, fearful man. Verses 9 and 10, we read now about this Doeg the Edomite. Just prior to 9 and 10, Saul is so lonely and fearful, suspicious. He calls his whole court together and says, "Do you see the son of Jesse, what he is doing and how people are rallying to him? And you people are like me." Now, he's just like maybe most people around the world. They like to get people of their own tribe, their own family, you know, around them so they're nice and comfortable. I wish to God that some of those things would change. Anyway, but he has these people around him, and they are all Bethlehemites, just like Saul. I'm sorry, Benjamites, just like Saul. David's a Bethlehemite from Judah. And Saul's telling his people, what's the tactic this leader is using? He says, "Don't you see you all Benjamites like me? That Bethlehemite, that fellow, the son of Jesse from Judah, do you think if he becomes king, he's going to give you favors like I give you because we have the same tribe?" And nobody says anything. And he's trying to pass on his suspicions, see if anyone's on his side, and then Doeg, verses 9 and 10, the Edomite, who is waiting to ingratiate. Those of us who are bosses, just be so careful. There are people who are so base and so low, who are waiting to ingratiate themselves to us so that they in turn may receive a favor. You bet Doeg was waiting for some reward, and I guarantee you all scholars agree that once he gave Saul this subversive information, he must have got a promotion and money and lands and everything else. And Doeg the Edomite says, "You know, the high priest Ahimelech, I saw David go to him, and he gave David and his men holy bread, and he gave David Goliath's sword." Doeg spoke the truth, but the way he put it was as if Ahimelech was in league with David, when really Ahimelech was trembling. He didn't want to do it. Ahimelech had his back to the wall. And that's all that Saul needed. Aha! Even the priests at Nob are in agreement with that son of Jesse. No wonder why the rest of the nation is rising up against me. And that's all Saul wanted to know. And he made some tremendous mistakes as a leader, which we'll discuss briefly. So Doeg told the truth, but not the whole truth. He set Saul against Ahimelech, and he gives substance to Saul's suspicion. Doeg is an example of a selfish or a self-seeking and malicious person who tells those in authority what they wish to hear rather than to give an accurate, truthful, honest account and a balanced account. In verses 11 through 23, here's what happens. As Saul has heard this about Ahimelech and the priests, he sends immediately for the priests at Nob. And Ahimelech is a spokesperson. And without really getting to the bottom of the matter, Saul doesn't give Ahimelech much of a chance. He says, "Why did you conspire with the son of Jesse against me?" You know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but look at Ahimelech's character. If you read that account, he never said one thing as far as letting David down. He didn't denounce David's duplicity. Remember, David said, "Saul sent me." Ahimelech never said that David said that, though he could have said it and spoken the truth. But Ahimelech saw David's heart was motivated by fear, and he understood that. Instead, as man to man, or high priest to king, he stood up to Saul and challenged Saul's motives. In other words, weren't you the one who caused David, the son of Jesse, to be so fear-filled that he came to me and lied to me? Instead of saying, "I'm sorry, sir, David lied to me," he said, "Sir, you are the one who's placed the fear in that man's heart." And Saul turns around and says, "That's enough. Which of my courtiers here will lay the sword to Ahimelech the priest and his fellow priests?" And not one of the soldiers of Saul was willing to do so. And then Doeg, that scumbag, that base, low of character, picks up the sword and slays this man of character, honesty, uprightness, and integrity, the high priest Ahimelech. And he goes on to slay 85 of the priests of Nob in one day, Doeg the Edomite. As bosses, let us be so careful that we are able to recognize the whole. I was saying, as bosses, let us be so careful that we recognize the truth, because Doeg told the truth, but not the whole truth. And in this massacre at Nob, there's four characters we want to look at. Ahimelech, when on trial for his life before Saul, he showed courage, integrity, and honor. Maybe you could have said he showed a lack of tact in that he challenged the king directly. Lying would have probably saved him his life. He could have denounced David's duplicity, but he challenged the king's attitude and motive towards David. He put truth, Ahimelech put truth before all else. And you know, folk, truth gives great moral strength in the time of crisis. That's why martyrs can die so peacefully, because they're overwhelmed by living and dying for the truth. The second character was Doeg. I said he was low enough, with enough base ambition to implicate and then to carry out this terrible massacre against Ahimelech and his priests without pity or compunction. And he was a self-serving person, served his own interests. The third character was David. When David heard about this, here's what he did. Immediately he took the blame. He said, "I should have known. That day I was talking to Ahimelech, I saw that character Doeg. I was tactless. I did not exercise wisdom. I should have known better." And see David's great attitude. He won. He took the blame. In verse 22b, you read that. Secondly, immediately from that massacre, by the way, only one of the priests escaped. And his name was Abiathar. So just as we're done with Ahimelech now, he's dead. Abiathar takes over as the next priest. Abiathar somehow escapes, and he comes with the ephod, the linen ephod with the breastplate, which contains the Urim and Thummim behind it. He escapes with that and runs to David, which we'll deal with that significance later. But David takes the blame. Secondly, he tells Abiathar, "I will protect you. Stay with me. No harm shall befall you if I can help it." And thirdly, David, he could so easily have done this. Can you believe he doesn't blame Saul when he hears about this incident? He says, I'm to blame. I should never have been there. I should never have let Doeg overhear this. He doesn't blame Saul. What more can you say about a man like that? And the fourth character was Saul himself. And now we'll look at the gross mistakes. One, he is guilty of gross brutality or bloodshed, wanton bloodshed and murder, because of a conspiracy that existed only in his own mind. David was never going to rise up against him. You see the disintegration of his personality. Secondly, with Saul, it was the same King Saul who had formerly saved Israel from her enemies. You listen to this closely. The same King Saul who formerly saved Israel from her enemies had now become the worst enemy of Israel's entire religious establishment. It was at his command 85 priests were slain. He was unfit to rule from this point on. I mean, this is it. He's crossed the returning point. Unfit to rule, the crown must pass to another man. And thirdly, about King Saul and us as leaders. A king or a leader must recognize the truth. Secondly, we must act with restraint and control our power. Thirdly, we must promote justice. The theme of the whole book, we've said, is leadership, leadership, leadership. We must recognize the truth. We need that ability. God, give us the ability to recognize the whole truth. Secondly, control, restrain our power, not be impulsive and hasty, and thirdly, promote good, peace, and justice. Saul failed on all these counts. Saul failed on every count. Now, not only he had no prophet, Samuel left him. Gad was with David. The priest, Abiathar, with the linen ephod, Urim and Thummim, he didn't have either. And guess who had both? David had. See the significance. David's beginning to look more and more like the king without the title yet. Chapter 23, verses 1 through 14, we have David and Keilah, the town or the city of Keilah. David, he hears about the Philistines conducting a raid, attacking the city of Keilah. And he is an exile. By now he's got another 200. His group has grown to 600 people. Okay, but he is with 600 people, and he hears, though he is on the run, that the Philistines are raiding Keilah, and he sends for his priest, for the priest of the nation, Abiathar. And he inquired of the Lord. You know what that means by now if you've been in this class, the Urim and Thummim. And the Lord says, yes, go up and deliver Keilah. He's not even the king, folk. He's running for his life. And David then, remember, though, he still inquired of the Lord. Here's a thought. David had the priest. He had the prophet. Saul didn't have the priest, the prophet. But the point is David, the key is that David used the resources he had. He used the men of God. He sought their counsel. He went to them. He submitted to their hearing from God. And God said, David, go ahead. I commission you to attack the Philistines and save, deliver the city of Keilah from the Philistines. And the same Hebrew word for save is Yashar. The kings in the Old Testament saved Israel from their enemies. Jesus today saves the whole world from our sins in a spiritual sense. Notice that God's chosen king, Saul was more what the people cried for as a king. David was God's chosen king. God's chosen king delivers God's people. He was a type fulfilled in the ultimate anti-type, Jesus Christ. But then, after the battle's over, David and his 600 men, etc., are in Keilah. Can you believe? They hear then that Saul has heard he's at Keilah, and Saul's on his case. Do you think the people of Keilah were going to give David refuge? But you don't blame them for not wanting to do so. What happened to Nob? Saul saw that all 85 priests were slain. David could not afford another Nob. He needed. I mean, who doesn't want the support of people? And this time, see, last time it was selfishness. He put his own interest, safety, above the priests. This time, he puts the safety of the people of Keilah above his own. He learned from his past mistakes. And that's okay if we make mistakes, so long as we learn from them. He was not going to let Keilah suffer again like Nob did. And here's another thought too. How could David stay in the city and hide? If he's one person, that's fine. With 600 men, you can hide 600. And if it's one person, somebody will give you food. Where are you going to get food for 600 people and still remain in hiding? You had to go to some barren place, and somehow you had to keep running and keep on the move. And so he chose to spare the people of Keilah, the citizens. He put their safety above his own. Here are some thoughts. For number one, he put the citizens' interest before his own. Secondly, he was still, I love this, he proved by defeating the Philistines at Keilah, David proved that he was still the Israelite champion against the Philistines. And in spite of Saul's relentless pursuit, David eluded Saul. In verse 14, we read that Saul just could not find him. And we read that David used the ephod of the priest Abiathar with the Urim and Thummim. Verses 15 through 29 of chapter 23. We have here a covenant between David and Jonathan, and then a very narrow escape for David. So let's look at the first portion of these verses, the covenant. David flees from Keilah southeast to the wilderness of Ziph. In verse 15 we read that he later went, that was in verse 15. And in verse 29, at the end of the chapter, we read that he later went to the strongholds of En-Gedi. It makes sense. He keeps running from place to place. Just a thought about En-Gedi in verse 29. It means spring of a goat. Now, that has nothing to do with a spring of water. It's like a coiled spring. In other words, it was that tough to get to. It would take a goat to get to it. spring of a goat, Engedi. So you really had to be pretty much in your peak form to be able to get to those places and hide in safety, Engedi. But for right now, he's in the wilderness of Ziph. And by the way, when you finally come to Engedi, that is right flush against the Dead Sea. So David then was really between a rock and a hard place. In this case, Saul on the one hand and the Dead Sea on the other. There was no escape. He had to keep shuttling and keep moving. His back was more and more to the wall. But right now again, he's in the wilderness of Ziph, and Saul is chasing him. He's in a precarious position. It's ironic, and perhaps some intentional humor by the original author of this story, of this book, that while Saul and his entire army cannot catch David, Jonathan finds David with ease. His Saul and his whole army can't find David, can never. And Jonathan wants to meet with David. It says Jonathan met with his friend. His friend. Jonathan finds his friend so easily. And here we have a sad story. It is the last story ever about dear, dear Jonathan. The last time we read about him meeting with David. The next time we read is in chapter 31 and verse 2, where Jonathan is slain with his father Saul in the battle. But let's look at this last time he and David are together. Three things Jonathan states if you read the account. Number one, Jonathan abdicates his right to the throne while Saul is grasping at it. Jonathan openly tells David, I know that you will yet be king over Israel. And you know what, David? I will be second next to you. The crown prince is telling David that when David's in exile. What a word of encouragement to David, because David knew he was anointed by the prophet to be king. You know, I sometimes wish, Lord, couldn't you have let Jonathan live and us see those two friends when David came to power? What a thought from Jonathan. I know you'll be king and I'll be second next to you, and I'll be so happy to be serving second in command next to you. Jonathan abdicates his right to the throne while Saul is grasping and clutching at it. Secondly, Jonathan encourages David while Saul causes him alarm and fear. Jonathan encourages David while Saul causes him alarm and fear. And this is, and he's emphasized that nothing could prevent David from becoming king. And I want us to look at those verses 16 and 17 in chapter 23 to hear what Jonathan's saying. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David. He found him with ease in the wood and strengthened his hand in God. Jonathan didn't give him bags of gold or all a lot of armor. He strengthened David's hand in God. In verse 17, he said, fear not, the hand of Saul my father will not find you, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee. And you know, even my dad Saul knows it. What an encouragement to David, who is on the run from Saul, fearing for his life. And what insight by Jonathan. He had to be in touch with God to perceive these things. Then in verses 19 through 29, we have the account of the Ziphites. In the wilderness of Ziph is where David was. They go and betray David to Saul. And David, in the account, flees to the city just southeast of Ziph, which is Maon. David runs down to Maon, and Saul comes down in full force, and this time he almost had him. It says Saul's army was on one side of the mountain, David's men were on the other side. They were about to be trapped, and at that point in time, Saul gets word, the Philistines are attacking us back home. And get this thought, God uses the Philistines to rescue David. He had had it. There was no escape. At that point, Saul gets the message. Philistines are attacking. God uses the Philistines to rescue David. Maybe in one sense we can look at that as a fulfillment of I'll give you the heathen for your inheritance. And many times, if we stop, God has performed many such miracles in our lives. It's not that an arm grew out of nowhere, but the timing that things happen. The miracle in this case wasn't the timing. And greater still in whom God used. And so many cases, God has performed so many such great miracles for us. But what happens is, we only understand that upon reflection after years. Yes, that was God. Here's the closing thought with this chapter. We see that the political situation here is a three-cornered struggle. Saul's enemies are the Philistines and David. The Philistines' enemies are David and Saul. David's enemies are the Philistines and Saul, not by his own choice, it's more on the defense. He's running for his life from him. And now, praise God, chapter 24. 1 Samuel chapter 24, we have Saul pursues David now with the choice band of 3,000 men. 3,000 men. And David has only 600, okay? And Saul goes to a cave. Little does he know that David and his men are in those caves. And the King James says to cover his feet in verse 3. That's a euphemism for today to say he went to the bathroom, okay? And Saul goes into the caves to relieve himself. And David very stealthily cuts off a piece of Saul's robe that he had taken off. And he could have killed Saul, but he chooses to spare Saul's life. And the dramatic irony is that David's narrow escape at Maon, remember the hill he was almost caught? Dramatic irony is shown in that David's narrow escape at Maon is followed right here by Saul's narrow escape at En-Gedi. This is right on the banks of the Dead Sea. This is a clear sign that God is on David's side. When David was almost caught, God rescues him. When Saul is almost dead, David chooses to spare him. Clear sign that God is on David's side. Saul never had David in the sense that he never had him in his clutches ever. David had Saul right there. He could have slain him. Saul would never have spared David if he had him in his clutches. David could spare and did spare Saul. Saul was suspicious, vindictive, and impulsive. David was more deliberate, merciful, magnanimous, giving his life freely and free from malice. David was more merciful, deliberate, magnanimous, and free from malice. Here's a thought. Why did David cut off a piece of Saul's robe? Why did he choose that particular type of action? One thought is, now we're not sure what their robes looked like on them, but however it was, it would have looked dressy a certain way. Now imagine this big piece cut off. Saul would have been made to look ridiculous when he put that thing on, and he probably wouldn't have discovered. Somebody else would have kind of started chuckling and saying, the king looks kind of strange, you know. So it would have made Saul look ridiculous. Secondly, this is an interesting thought. It could have been a symbolic action similar to the rending of Samuel's mantle by Saul, where Samuel turned around and said, so also your kingdom will be rent from you. This time, David's holding the peace. It's like, I'm stealing a piece of your kingdom, boy. I've got it in my hands. Could be. That's an interesting thought. But for this chapter 24, it is the main theme of this chapter is the royal status and the right to life of a king. It's quite interesting with the right to life there, but the royal status and the right to life of a king. David says, I won't kill him. I won't touch the Lord's anointed. Now we're not done with that chapter yet. Look at this. Contrast verses 4 and 6. In verse 4, and I have this marked up here clearly. Verse 4, it says, and the men of David said to him, remember what the Lord said? Behold, I'll deliver thine enemy into thine hand. How did the men of David, his 600 men, see Saul as David's enemy? And contrast that with verse 6. And David said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this to my master, the Lord's anointed. We're talking, the theme of the book is leadership. What a leader. He looked at Saul not as his men saw Saul as an enemy, but as my master, the Lord's anointed. I love how Shakespeare puts it in this one, Macbeth, where the king is murdered and the one, the sons don't know it, and the one nobleman, Macduff, comes out and says, don't you know what's happened? And the son says, no. He says, what? You are and you know it not? You're living and you don't know what's happening? The Lord's anointed temple hath broken open. Somebody has stabbed and gored open the body of your father. The respect they had for the king was the Lord's anointed temple. And David here calls Saul, my master, the Lord's anointed. David, listen to this, his men in verse 4 said, that's your enemy. Remember, the Lord said, I will deliver him into your hand. They quoted what the Lord had said to him. David must have been greatly tempted to heed their advice and to slay Saul. And that would have been the end of his problems. I can guarantee you, Saul's 3,000 men army would instantly have come over to David's side. That would have been it. Next day, in 24 hours, they could have had a coronation ceremony. He must have been greatly tempted while he was listening to his men. We're talking to leaders. We're talking leadership here. But you see, David's perspective upon Saul was not through the eyes of his men, but through the eyes of God. He was looking at it from God's perspective. God sends Samuel to anoint Saul, the Lord's anointed. And so we see more of David's character, more of his strength, his fitness to become king. It's almost like you want to take him and make him king, you know, make this happen quicker. And so you see, he calls him my master, the Lord's anointed. Saul to David was both the king, still the king, and personal enemy. But David saw this from God's perspective. Too often, we put personal consideration first. In circumstances like that, we are quick to put ourselves and look at our best. But David put God's perspective. He showed mercy and political insight. After this was over, Saul leaves the cave. And David stands up, shouts out, and he confronts Saul in a gentle way, not screaming at him. David confronts Saul, calls out to him, and says, my lord, my master, look here. And he shows him the piece of the mantle. That was the height of courage for David to take that risk, because Saul could have turned around and killed him with his 3,000 men. So David demonstrates tremendous courage. In verse 8b, we read, when David got Saul's attention, Saul turned around, that David stooped and bowed down to the earth as a continuing sign of great respect. You are the king. You are the Lord's anointed. And out of reverence to Saul as the Lord's anointed one. And he then in verse 13 quotes a proverb. Let's quick look at that. David says, while he's talking to Saul, as says the proverb of the ancients, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but mine hand shall not be upon thee. The best way to look at that proverb is, the proverb says wickedness comes from the wicked. In other words, if I were truly a wicked man, only wickedness would come from me. I would have slain you. But if I didn't slay you, I cannot be a wicked man. You get the point there. And then he goes on to see, after whom does my lord pursue? After a dead dog or a flea? He's being very tactful. He says, I'm as harmless to you as a flea could bite you, or as a dead dog could bite you. I'm no harm to you at all, or danger. Can't you trust me? And that does break Saul only temporarily. Saul's surprising admission in verses 17 and 20, he actually, just watch those few lines. In verse 17, he says to David, is this not my son David? Saul lifted up his voice and wept. In verse 17, he says to David, thou art more righteous than I. David, you're a better man than I am. Verse 20, he says, I know well, can you believe Saul is saying this, not Jonathan? I know well that thou shalt surely be king, that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in thy hand. So that's quite a surprising admission from Saul. It shows us that he had his lucid, clear thinking, clairvoyant moments when he really knew what was going to happen, where he was hearing from God even. And he even approved David's succession to the throne, but there's no suggestion. Are you noticing this in the last few verses? Saul never says, come back to the court. He says, God bless you. I know you're going to become king. I can't stop you. Have a good day in the jungles. I'm going back to the court. There's no invitation from Saul. They both go their separate ways in verse 22, we read. Saul understands and accepts that he has been rejected. And David has been established as king. And the final thought, you know what he tells David? Please be merciful to my family when you do become king. Goodbye.